You are listening to CFRO Community Radio Station on 102.7 FM. The upcoming show, Conscious Living Radio, is a program that explores frontiers of consciousness, spirituality, personal growth, emerging paradigms in psychology, health, science, and innovative philosophies that reflect commitment to the advancement of individual, social, and global transformation.
Good evening. You're listening to Conscious Living Radio. My name is Andrew Resmer, and today I'll be talking to Michael Mead, who was a leading figure in the metapoetic branch of the men's movement of 1980s all the way until 2005. He is an accomplished scholar of mythology, poetry, and traditional ritual, a storyteller, a mentor to disadvantaged youth, and a drummer. He continues his work today under auspices of non-profit organization, the Mosaic Multicultural Foundation. We're excited that Michael Mead is coming to Vancouver in just a few days. On Friday, January 28th, he'll be presenting the evening lecture, Facing Fate, Finding a Destiny. This event will be celebrating the release of Michael's new book under the same title. On next day, on Saturday, January 29th, he'll lead an intensive workshop, The Initiated Soul, The Awakened Self. You can register over the phone for those events with Bunyan Books at 604-737-8858, or get more information and registration by visiting the Mosaic website at www.mosaicvoices.org. Links to that webpage and information details are also on consciouslivingradio.org. Hi, Michael. Thanks for sharing your wisdom with us today. Can you start by telling us about your path that brought you where you are today?
Well, in a sense, everybody's path begins at birth, but the conscious path, in a way, began on my 13th birthday when I received a book of myths by mistake. My aunt, thinking she was giving me a history book, this is what I call fate or destiny, both of those, gave me a book of myths. And at that time, 13 years old, living in the city of New York, I did see what the world meant to me. I got a glimpse of my way of seeing the world. And it took me maybe 20 years before I could figure out what to do with that. And so then I'm in my 30s, and I decide to put out a flyer offering a workshop on Irish mythology. I had no idea if anybody would be interested at all. I just had a need to speak about it. And to my great surprise, a whole room full of people showed up. And so I began teaching mythology. And immediately, I realized that in order to teach myth, I had to tell stories, that people were going to get it better and get it in a way that made more personal meaning for them if they got it through a story. And it was in the process of doing that that I asked people, well, where would you be in that story? What struck you most about the story? And I had this experience of seeing how each person finds their own story in a mythic story. And that really opened up a path that I have been following ever since. That's 30 years now. And that is to say, the path that brings the individual story into contact with one of the mythic themes of the world and of life. And I'm still on that path myself, still looking for and finding, thank goodness, connections between the story I'm living and the great myths that you find throughout the world, and then trying to help other people do the same thing, because the old saying is myth makes meaning. Experience doesn't make meaning. Experience just makes experience. Myth makes meaning. When a person can see and feel their own story against the backdrop of a mythic tale, suddenly the meaning of it becomes much more clear, and the direction of a person's life can become clarified as well.
Mm-hmm. And obviously that role of myths and stories have evolved over centuries and millenniums. That the myth and the story was the media that was used to convey sometimes wisdom that is not easily conveyed. Right now, when we are competing with TV, internet, and ways of conveying wisdom in a very short, very direct, very blunt information, I think there is an even deeper need to go back to those old ways of conveying wisdom.
Oh yeah, there's plenty of evidence of that. I tell stories all over the world, and no matter the age of the people involved, or whether it's gang youth that I happen to be working with, or faculty members at a university, everyone quickly, almost immediately, almost irrepressibly relates to something in the story. And, you know, many poets have said it in several different ways, but from the mythic point of view, this story is not made, this world is not made from atoms, it's made out of stories. Mm. And from an African point of view, the more a person learns of their story, the more they're helping the world to stay alive as well. In other words, the world, what we call the world, is a big story, a story written large, the great drama of life on a whole, as we now call it, planetary level. But that story is really informed to a large degree by the individual human stories. And now that the world seems to be falling apart often, or now that many people think that the world could end either through human error or human terror, or through radical climate change, it's the individual story that gives a person a place to stand in the world. People used to find themselves more readily inside the great shared myths, but we don't have the shared myths now. We tend to have the sound bites now. And so I urge people to find the threads of their own inner story, for that gives a person the possibility of greater presence in the world. And as I've written over the past several years, there is a story inside each person trying to come out. And the closer a person gets to that inner story, the more readily they find purpose and meaning and direction in their life.
And there is going to be opportunity just in a few days here in Vancouver to meet you in person, here, and participate in lectures or workshop where you're going to be sharing many stories and selling, offering books and tapes, CDs with even more of those stories. And opportunity to interact. I know I've had privilege to be part of some of your lectures or workshops, and they always seem to be interactive, where individuals are asked to actually find themselves in the story, and it's the story becomes interwoven between the past and the present. And so you're going to be here in Vancouver on 20, I believe on Friday, end of this month, 29th and 30th. Is that correct?
That's correct. Correct. And I'll be speaking and telling stories specifically about fate and destiny.
And that's the title of your new book.
Yes. Yes. Of course, I'm trying to sell a book, but even mythologists have to do that.
Well, I'm grateful because in my life, it seems that your stories really awaken something in me that is much deeper than other ways I've been trying to awaken those other levels of awareness. So let's start going deeper into fate and destiny by defining what fate is and what destiny is.
To be honest, there are two different ways of referring to the mystery of a person. And, you know, we live in a world now where everybody wants the facts and everybody wants the bottom line. But in a sense, the bottom line of the human soul remains mystery. And then you could also say each person is a mystery trying to be revealed in the world. And then what I've been doing is saying, okay, there's two big energies that are part of each person's life. I mean, there's many other ways to look at it, but this one intrigues me. And fate is the part of a person's life that has limitations in it. It's the distinct elements of one's birth. A person is male or female. They're healthy or unhealthy. They're born into a wealthy family or a medium family or a poor family. They're born in Canada. They're born in Africa. They're born in Mexico. These are elements of fate in the sense that no one gets to choose those exactly. They more or less seem to happen to us, or they're chosen by some unseen hand. It used to be, mythologically, everybody understood that it was the sisters of fate who were making this shape by pulling the thread of one's life. So that's one part, the restrictions or the limitations in one's life, which can be beautiful limitations and also can be painful limitations. Those limitations continue in the sense that everybody has fateful experiences. The accident, that's not an accident. The way that a person meets someone else and it becomes fateful because it leads to marriage or because it leads to some danger, whatever that is, the elements that we don't choose but that seem to choose and affect us, I'm calling those fate. The opposite energy is destiny, from the Latin destinare, which in one sense means the destination we're going to, but in another sense means of the stars. That is to say, our destiny is the way that we're related to the cosmos and the stars, and it's the eternal thread that goes through us. And from the old mythic point of view, the thread of our destiny is actually pulling us through life. And so that's the place where we want to wind up, where we give our gifts, our natural gifts, and where we fulfill some kind of hidden purpose in the soul. And then lately when I've written about it, I've been making the suggestion that a person's destiny, their destination, their purpose, their goal, is most often nearby when fate has interfered with their life. And so that's the part that intrigues me now, that when we feel most constricted, we are also close to our destiny. When we feel we have no place to turn, the place to turn is deep inside where the thread of destiny is waiting to be found. That's what I've been writing about.
So it's almost like destiny is using fate to help us on the right path.
That's very close to an old Irish idea. In the old Irish myths, the way the stories go, it will be often an old woman, actually, who represents fate, but she also is in touch with destiny, and she puts the obstacles in the path of a person that are most likely to provoke their sense of destiny. Mm. So, whereas in the modern world, people are often looking for comfort or trying to avoid trouble, in the mythic world, getting into trouble is the proper job of a person. The only issue is whether a person gets into the right trouble or the wrong trouble. The right trouble is the kind of trouble that troubles you so much that you have to go to the deepest resources of your soul, and in doing that, you find the hints and the threads of destiny. And in the book I wrote that if a person doesn't find this path of destiny, then no matter what they do with their life, they will be unsatisfied at the end.
Mm-hmm. So I guess for us, people who try to be the best we can be in this incarnation, in this life, and we may not know what that destiny is that our soul is trying to fulfill. And we seem to be bumping into different troubles, and we don't even know at the time if this is a right trouble or a wrong trouble. How can we distinguish all of that?
That's a very good question. And when I first started talking about this years ago, many years ago, most people were just confused. They were just saying things like, well, I'm 42 years old, and I have no idea what my destiny is. I'm barely keeping a job, and I've been trying, they're almost offended to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the way I think about it. If a person could stand wherever they are today and, stop, which is rare enough in the modern world, and then look back over their life and look back with an eye for what is remarkable, what is indelible in one's life, then they will begin to see in the book I write about how, for instance, I wound up in a military prison.
Mm-hmm.
And in that this had to do with me realizing that I couldn't fight in the Vietnam War. Unfortunately, I realized it most deeply when I was already in the Army, and I realized when they explained to me that I would basically have to just kill on orders, I realized, oh, that wasn't going to work for me, that was a problem for my soul. And I tried to get out, but instead I just got further in, and I eventually wound up in solitary confinement. Now, that was a very painful experience for me, especially to be in solitary by myself, which is difficult for a person who speaks as much as I do, for months and months. And yet, if you took that experience away from me, I would probably not really be present, because in that fateful restriction of a prison cell, far from home and out of touch with anyone at all, I found inside my soul again these stories that I had started reading when I was 13 years old. And instead of being completely alone, even though I was in total isolation, I was not alone, because the stories and the characters in the stories were with me. And in the midst of that, you know, I keep calling it fateful occurrence because there were many accidents that got me there, I actually found myself. And when I got out, I was a different person. I actually knew that I was a person tied to myth and story, and also that my own story was such that I could not do things that were a violation to my soul. So even now, as I talk about it, I go back and visit it again, and it gives me one of the places in my life to stand. It gives me a place where I began to know myself. And after that, my life was completely different in the sense that I had a place to go to from where I could make all the deep decisions of my life, and in which I could find, I don't know how to explain it, a deep sense of being that was not determined by anyone outside myself or any force outside myself. So that's a little bit extreme, but I think if anyone looks back in honesty and clarity over the course of their life, they will find events. Some of those events are, I call them golden moments. A person realizes that they can play the piano. Anybody can take piano lessons, but some people can actually play as if the music is waiting in them to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else becomes a dancer. Someone else becomes a scientist, not because it's a good career to choose, but because scientific knowledge is waiting to be awakened in them. So those are on the positive seeming side of things. And then the other things are just as indelible and as important. The first ones, the ones that are positive, the talents, you could say, I call the gifts of the soul. And then the other side are the restrictions that also have a lot of information in them. Someone has a nervous breakdown that has a completely different meaning to the soul than it does to the parents of that person or in social life what it means. For the soul, it means that the person, who, for instance, who has a nervous breakdown is actually being taken into what they used to call an underworld initiation. In other words, breaking down is leading them to a knowledge hidden in them.
Mm-hmm.
They may need some guidance in figuring out how to get out of that and what to do with it, but some of the best therapists are those who have survived their own breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
So even things that are seemingly negative or even destructive, in the way I'm looking at it, mythically, cannot help but reveal some qualities residing in the soul. In the book, I make a point of describing the soul from the point of view of ancient mythology found throughout the world, as opposed to later ideas. Most modern people think of the cosmos or the world as accidental, scientific idea, and then it kind of leads to the notion that each person is an accident in an accidental world. And then religiously, many people believe that the soul comes into the world as a blank slate. Catholics call it the tabula rasa. But the old myths of the world, and this is true in South America and in Alaska and in Africa and even in ancient Europe, the old myths all seem to agree that each person comes into the world already gifted and with the story that's trying to live through them. And what I'm suggesting is the two things that often provoke that inner story and can help to reveal it are finding one's gifts and one's way to give to the world on one hand, and then finding the specific aspects and elements of suffering which happen to everybody on the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
A person can look through their life for when some gifts came out or when they felt golden. Some people have a tremendous capacity for empathy, and very young they began to listen to the stories of other people, and they began to take those stories very deeply inside them. That's an empathic person, and that's a rare gift. And people can find that even if it's not valued in the modern world that's so externalized. On the other hand, everybody has something, an injury, a loss, an illness, a failure, a mistreatment, that when it's paid attention to, begins to reveal very specific aspects of who they already are inside. And I'm suggesting that everybody already is someone inside, and that on the road of learning what our gifts are and on the road of suffering our fateful experiences, there are many, many hints of who we are to begin with.
And I guess the trick is that when we're in the middle of the trouble, when we're in the middle of this fateful experience, where it feels like hell, to have, to have faith, to have willingness to see that this occurrence is putting us back in towards our destiny.
Yes, and that's why the bigger story of the world is important. The cosmological story right now is the story of the accidental universe. And that is making everybody unsteady. People are, and that unsteadiness goes in two directions, typically. Some people are grabbing onto something and believing in it, even if it's completely unbelievable. So you have the fundamentalist, the growth of fundamentalism of all kinds, because the general sense is that this whole thing might mean nothing, and so people grab something and hold on to it rigidly. On the other hand, if the whole thing might mean nothing, then it doesn't matter much what I do or how I act, and people become less ethical, less moral, I guess, and only do things for their own benefit. Mm-hmm. The old idea, the mythic idea, is that each soul is a story trying to reveal itself, and that meaning is carried within from actually before birth, that each person is a carrier of meaning. But there's a huge thing, and actually you and I have spoken about this before,
mm-hmm.
which is that many traditional cultures used to engage young people after adolescence, what we now call teenagers, engage them in such a way as to put them into severe enough circumstances that they begin to reveal from the inside who they already are. And modern culture doesn't do that, so you have many grown-ups or people looking grown up, but what has not grown inside them is the story of who they are, of what inner capacities and what inner purposes they brought to the world. Instead of that kind of artful creation of the right kind of trouble, we have people randomly getting in trouble all over the place, and then we also have people thinking that what's most important is the career you choose in life. And, of course, the old stories say it's way more important that a person be chosen rather than that they simply make careful choices.
Mm-hmm. And that obviously is going back to this concept of a soul who made some choices even before incarnating or before coming to this way of expressing itself. And some of those paths may have been predesigned. Can you tell us a little bit more about the concept of soul and spirit?
Well, there's lots of ways to go at it. And usually it's presented, it used to be presented in threes. The modern world are always two kinds of choices. The political choices tend to go conservative or liberal, that kind of thing. People think that's the whole story. And then there's many other pairings that people go by, young and old, good and bad, male and female. But that's not really the world. The world is always more intricate than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so people used to talk about three ways of viewing the world, and that would be matter or body, and then on the other extreme, spirit or mind, and in the middle would be soul. So soul, on one way of looking at it, it's the part that unites matter and the body with spirit and the mind. So when you have in the modern world the famous mind-body split, the missing piece is soul.
Mm-hmm.
Soul is that which connects all things one to the other. Another aspect of it is called Eros, as in erotic. And Eros was the god that went between all the other gods. Eros is also that which connects a person to nature. Someone loves to be by a river. Another person loves to be walking in the mountains. That used to be called their Eros for the world. And one of the things that's going on is there's less soul present in the world, and therefore everything becomes more divided. So that's one way to go. Then you can also take soul and spirit and contrast the two.
Mm-hmm.
When you do that, you say, well, spirit is connected to fire and air, both of which tend to rise up. So spiritual ideas and spiritual talk will always be uplifting. It's trying to get to a higher place. It's trying to get to a higher self. It's trying to get saved from falling down. Whereas soul is connected to water and to earth, both of which move downwards.
Mm-hmm.
And so the earth has its gravity that keeps pulling everything down, and water runs downhill. And soul tends to move down, always looking for a deeper view or a deeper feeling. And so when people talk about understanding, they're really talking about soul. And soulful understanding is a deeper thing than high levels of knowledge. And so from a certain point of view, you could say a proper education involves a deepening of the sense of self and a sense of the world, as well as higher learning.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's happened also in this world is those two things are more divided than they should be, so that people think that spirit is the only important thing, when really spirit and soul are trying to find each other. And soul involves those things that move down and go around and take the sidetrack and take the kind of meandering trail. That's soulful, when a person is just wandering and following their own feelings and their own soul. And spirit wants to go straight and get there right away and get everything clear. And a person has to live both of those things. And so then you turn it around and say both of those things move through our body. The feelings connected to the heart are more soulful. The thoughts connected to the mind are more spirit things. And the body holds those together.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you could say soul holds the body and the mind together.
Is soul more individual and spirit more towards oneness?
Very good question. Spirit wants to move towards a unity above all.
Mm-hmm.
Above all. Soul wants to move into a diversity that distinguishes all.
Mm-hmm.
And so spirit talk will go high, so you get the overview and the over-spirit. It used to actually be called the over-soul. And soul wants to keep breaking it down to the individual piece. Soul is connected to diversity, and spirit is more connected to unity. And so people used to say, well, which is it going to be? And of course, the answer was both. This world is made of a oneness from which everything derives. When everything derives, then becomes a multiplicity. And whenever either one is lost, the world is losing something. Mm. And the job of a person is to go as high as they can into their imagination and into their ideas and into their capacity to live in a fulfilled way, but also to go as deep as each person can into the depths of feeling and into the roots of compassion and into the places of love. And a person is only full if they're doing both of those things. And of course, in doing both of those things, there's all kinds of failures And the more earthly failures tend to be the source of humor and therefore comedy. And the ones that seem to be more like a spiritual mistake or confusion can often feel like the things that create tragedy.
And in that context, what is the role of dreams?
Dreams are the universal evidence that each person has a soul. And of course, the modern world, they try to reduce dreams. The modern world tries to reduce a lot of things, especially the serious things. But it tries to reduce dreams to kind of perturbations of the body or simple reflections or reactions to the previous 12 hours or something. But they also, in modern review, say that if you don't dream, you might die. Dreaming is at the center of the soul. And if you take it from a, let's say, African tribal point of view, they would often be saying that the dreams are being sent to you by the wise ancestors. So the dreams are like an inner mythology. The message is coming from who knows how far. In South America, there's a number of tribes that say the dreams are messages from the very center of the cosmos. But as it gets closer to the person, it has to take the elements of their life in order to make it meaningful. So the basic message might be some deep message, you know, like a Jungian idea, like you're carrying the golden self. That would be somewhat close to Jungian notions. But the dream can't just come in, you know, enter it like an email and say you're carrying the golden self and everything's going to be fine. That's not interesting enough, it's not creative, and it's not personal enough. So the dream will send some kind of strange piece of information. Like, I had a dream just two nights ago in which I was lost. I wasn't sure where I was. I had got beyond crowds of people. And then I noticed I was carrying this copper gold coat. And thinking in the dream, the me in the dream was thinking, God, I don't know if I'd ever wear this coat anywhere. How did I get this coat? But then when I worked on the dream, I realized the dream, the source of dreams, was reminding me that there was something golden even in my life, and that it could be sometimes worn like a coat, like a protective garment. And then once you start with that, you can do research, and then all of a sudden you can find a whole bunch of stories and myths that have these golden garments in them. So the dream, on one hand, you could say, takes the elements of the previous 24 hours and turns them into a drama or a story that has information in it that we didn't see while we were awake and living through it. That's one way to work with dreams. And then at another level, you could say that dreams are constantly offering the specific elements of the individual alchemy for that person's soul. And by alchemy, I mean the material from which we could grow a full and awakened self.
In your book, Fate and Destiny, you have included over, I think, almost 30 stories. And I'm going to play one of those stories for our listeners, Isaac's Dream.
Oh, yeah.
You ready for a story? So this will be a familiar story to many of you. It certainly is to me. The trick with a story is to not let the ego say, I know that. Famous old trick. But to find out what the story is trying to say today. For each day we wake up in a different world, on a different part of the path, usually facing a different obstacle, always trying to gather another piece of learning. So once upon a time, once in another time, once in another place, once in a small village, there was a simple hut, and in it lived a man named Isaac, and Isaac himself was rather simple. That is to say, he had come to live a simple life with not complicated needs and accepting pretty much what the day would bring to him. But it happened that at night, while sleeping, Isaac had a dream. And it happened that in the dream, a voice spoke directly to him, saying, Isaac, it is time to go to a distant city and to the center of that city and to a bridge that you will find there in the midst of the city. And time to go to the base of that bridge and begin digging in the ground that is there. For if you do that, you will find a great treasure. And Isaac woke up and thought, well, just a dream. Just a dream. And then after a time, it happened that Isaac had a dream again. And it happened that it was the same dream that came to Isaac again, telling him to go to that distant city and to the center of the city and to find that bridge and dig at the base of the bridge. And there he would be finding a great treasure. And this time, because the dream had come back, he mentioned it to some friends. And they said, well, a dream is just a dream. And Isaac went back to living the way he had been living. And then it happened that the dream came a third time. And the third time it came, Isaac woke up that day and he left everything he knew behind. Isaac left the hut that he had been living in. He left the village of people that he had grown with. Isaac left his work. He left his cares. He left everything that he had behind. And Isaac began walking on the road that went from that village to the great city that was described in the dream. And Isaac walked day and night, for it was a long way to go. And Isaac had only his feet to carry him. And it happened that after walking for a long distance, he walked right through the soles of his shoes, so that pretty soon Isaac was walking barefoot. And it happened that as he was walking, the winds would blow and it would lift the dust of the earth. And so Isaac's clothes became covered with dust. And in fact, he began to wear through some of his clothes, so that Isaac was looking like a pretty strange person walking barefoot in tattered clothes on this road that he was traveling along. Nonetheless, it came to the point where Isaac arrived at the city that was mentioned in the dream. And at that point, Isaac entered the city. And without wasting time and following what the dream had described, Isaac went straight to the center of the city. And there he could see a bridge that went right to the castle that was in the midst of the city. And he went towards the bridge, hoping to dig at the base of the bridge, when he saw before him guards guarding the bridge. Kind of a homeland security situation. And Isaac realized that it would be unlikely that they will allow him to go down and dig at the base of the bridge. And not knowing what else to do, Isaac began to pace back and forth in front of the bridge, day and night, looking at it in his tattered clothes, in his bare feet. After a time, the captain of the guard came to Isaac and said, listen, I've seen you walking here with this anxious look on your face, and I wonder what has happened to you. And Isaac said, what has happened to me is I had a dream three times that told me to come here and dig at the base of this bridge and that I would find a great treasure. But I'm afraid to go there because of you and all of the guards. And the captain said, you know, by your age, a person usually knows better. I'm surprised to find you acting in such a foolish way as to be following a dream. Everybody knows that dreams don't mean anything. For instance, last night I myself had a dream, and in the dream it said that a person named Isaac would come to me. And if that person named Isaac knew enough to go back to the village where he grew up and back to the hut where he had lived, and if he went to the hearth that was in the back of the hut, he would find some loose bricks, and if he loosened those bricks, he would find a tremendous treasure right there back in the place he came from. And Isaac simply said, thank you very much. He turned around, and Isaac began to walk back towards the place he had begun at. Isaac walked back to the village of his growth. Isaac walked back to his little hut. It took him a long time, as it had taken him coming out. And on the way back, Isaac was still walking barefoot, although I'll tell you, So much time had gone by that his clothes were back in fashion. Isaac found his way back, went directly to the hut where he had been living, entered the hut, went to the hearth at the back of the hut, and sure enough, there were some loose bricks. He pulled them out, as the dream of the captain had suggested, and there he found, in his own hearth, a great treasure. And Isaac took that treasure and built a grand house out of stone, a sweet-looking building in the midst of a forest. And he built a hall inside that building, not to show off, but to invite the neighbors in and to invite his friends. And when they came, Isaac would say, "Have you had a dream?" And people would tell their dreams. And Isaac would sit with them and talk over the dreams. And pretty soon, everybody was working on their dreams. And people were making their journeys not based on promises, but based on dreams. Isaac's dream had led him to become a keeper of dreams, an interpreter of dreams. And that's the story of Isaac, who, as far as I know, is still there in the house that he built, still there in that psychic house where people share dreams. At least, that's what I hope is the case. I don't really know. But when I think of it laying down at night, I think of Isaac and his house of dreams.
Can you tell us what is the meaning of that story?
So, a story has many layers of meaning. Some people say there are seven. Let's just say there are many. And it has different meaning for each person. And what strikes a person most in the story is like a door that opens for them to enter the story. Story means storehouse. And what's stored in stories is what everybody keeps forgetting. And so in Isaac's dream, everybody keeps forgetting that we're each carrying a dream, the dream of our own life. Call it the inner story. Call it the inner dream. It's the sense that our life is aimed at something beautiful and meaningful. To me, this is an important notion, and it's not just that some people get to have meaning in their life. It's that everybody is imbued with meaning, and that's why you treat other people with respect, because you never know when a person is going to wake up and contribute exactly what everybody needs. And in the case of Isaac, he's like a common person. His life is ordinary. He lives like everybody else, and he's denying the dream of his life. But, you know, in stories, things come in threes, and finally, he can't deny it. Now, even though his friends, in a certain sense, don't want to recognize the dream he's carrying, and a lot of people can have that experience. You try something out, and everybody says, that's weird. Well, sometimes what a person has to follow is weird. And people who are not living the dream of their lives are often trying to cancel the dreams of those who are trying to awaken. So sometimes the person has to just trust themselves. And in Isaac's case, he has to leave and go to this distant city. And that's part of an old notion that says that you have to go out in the world and you have to try yourself. You have to test yourself in the world or you won't find out who you are. And, you know, even if you follow a notion like be here now, I know that's popular again, but the people who get to be here now have been everywhere else first. They don't always say that, but that's the truth. You only get to be here now once you've been out there somewhere. And in the course of the adventures, you get worn down, or in the story, you get kind of stripped down. And it's when a person is exposed and stripped down that which is hidden within comes out. No one has ever grown and become themselves by hiding or by resting on a couch. A person becomes themselves by stripping away everything that isn't themselves. And our friend Isaac makes it all the way there, and he's close to the gold that he was looking for, the gold that the dream told him to seek. And then that starts a whole new cycle. When a person gets close to the essence, they are both mightily attracted to it, and they also are repelled from it. It's a magnetic thing that attracts you and pushes you away. And in the midst of that is when a person suffers the deepest distrust and fears and self-negation of their life. And so Isaac kind of digs a hole in the ground with his own concerns and his own worries. And he's so far into the suffering of that, when the captain of the guard comes, who he is afraid of, he answers the question of, what are you doing, honestly? Because he's down to kind of the last thing he has, which is his own honesty. And that would be the point at which a person, you know, really admits what is wrong in their life or what's not working, because they're desperate now to change it. And even though it's embarrassing or a great vulnerability, they admit it. That's what happens when a person goes into therapy or seeks help. They acknowledge what the pain and suffering is, and that is what begins to change it. And that's what happens to Isaac. And he explains that he's following a dream, and at that point, some little magic in the story occurs, because the captain, who doesn't believe in dreams, actually delivers the next dream information to Isaac. That's the point of the Greek turnaround in the story. And that's connected to the old idea that when things are ready to really change, the change can come even from someone who's opposed to your well-being or opposed to you changing. At that point, the universe, as they say, is trying to help. And so the information from the captain's dream tells Isaac to go all the way back and dig in the hearth in his little hut, and he'll find a golden treasure. And that's a code or a symbol. You take the H away from heart and you have heart. And the story is saying that the gold we're all looking for is hidden in the depths of our own heart. But we can only find it when we go out and test ourselves in the world and strip away what a lot of people call the ego or the willfulness of the self, in order to finally reveal the dream hidden inside, the gold hidden inside, the genius hidden inside the heart.
And the dreams are the universe's way of trying to help us reach our destiny. In this world right now, in the West especially, we're missing on a huge opportunity to learn from dreams. What kind of advice could you give us? How can we change our approach to dreams to get those teachings?
Well, for the most part, it's pretty simple. I've been keeping a dream journal myself for probably 35 or more years. And what I simply do is get up each morning, and whether it's a fragment or, you know, a great epic, I write the dream down, such as I find it, and I write it down exactly as I recall it. I don't change it or alter it, even though I'm a writer. I always think I could improve it, but I try to get it down exactly, because it's speaking a language that my ego can't fully get. And so I trust how it comes. And then once I've written it down and I'm looking at it, then I tend to rewrite it, in the sense that I try to catch the associations that are in me towards it, in the dream of the coat. What other coats can I relate that to? You know, what coat does it make me think of? That kind of thing. And then I go into the area of, what did this feel like? What were the feelings in it? In the case of that dream, I felt like I was lost and unsure of where to turn, and I felt that I had gone past everything I knew. So that feeling was there at the same time that this strange and possibly valuable garment was there. And that shows you something about the psyche, that when we enter a new area and we challenge ourselves to step past those things that we know, we will feel disoriented before we become newly oriented. And so I will go through that, what does it feel like, and so on. And then if I have the time, and I don't always have the time, I will begin to look for the mythological or the mythic level of it. And so you take garments and coats and cloaks, and you can open up, just especially nowadays, if a person happens to use the internet, you can do very rapid searches for images, symbols, and mythic themes on the internet, or a person can do it through books. So I wind up then having a dream that is the story or the drama, the way it was presented to the psyche, just written out. I can return to it. And then the second part of it will be associations and feelings related to that. And then the third part will be mythological. Then what happens is the dream psyche, the dream source, whatever you want to call it, whoever's cooking up the dreams, says, oh, look, they're paying attention. Let's send them some more. Suddenly the dreams are improving. because attention has been brought to that part of the psyche. And over time, a person begins to recognize their own kind of dream lexicon, their own series of images and themes that make sense in their life. And for instance, I'll just go back to my dream.
Mm-hmm.
Along with other dreams, it is communicating to me that I'm at a point in my life where I have passed beyond a number of things that I would consider to be normal, a regular part of my life. And I'm in a new territory. That's very helpful. Instead of just saying, gee, I don't know what's going on and feeling sorry for myself or feeling that I have to be terrified or very confused, the dream is kind of by virtue of giving me this new coat, saying that it's maybe worth going on, like Isaac, and getting past everything that everyone has told me about life in order to discover something that is waiting to be known.
Hmm.
In a funny way, we can only truly learn more by walking past what we already know. New knowledge waits in a territory that's beyond everything we know. And a dream like the one I had is trying to remind me of that.
Is there a value in sharing dreams with people who know us but may not be us attached to the interpretation, that kind of fresh view? I know that you have told us during your workshops that it used to be part of the daily routine in the small communities to start a day with sitting in the circle and sharing dreams.
And it still is in many places. It's considered the most human thing to do in the morning in many cultures, that there is more than one world. And there's the daily world that everybody, you know, goes to work in and struggles with this way and that, parents, children, and all that kind of stuff. And then when you lay down to sleep, you're in a completely different world. You know, in a person's dreams, some people think the most common dream is a flying dream. The next most common is a falling dream. So in the dreams, people are flying and falling, and you're older than you are, you're younger than you are, you can change genders, you can, all kinds of things. You're all... grade school classmates come back. Everything is possible in a dream. And so one of the best things to do is to somehow share this other world that we all participate in with others. And, of course, it's very hard in the modern world to do that every morning. But to do it once in a while, to do it repeatedly with people that actually care for us, who then share their dreams with us, all of a sudden you're starting, unlike in the beginning of Isaac's story, instead of the neighbors saying, oh, cut it out, you're making yourself too special, instead of that, you have people beginning to pay care and attention to the dreams of each other. And I think that's a way more human situation. And people that I have worked with dreams with friends over many, many years, I'll tell them a dream. They already know the kind of dreams I have. They already know the kind of struggles in my life. And they would be very helpful in showing me things that I'm not seeing.
Hmm.
Or in reminding me, oh, you've been in this kind of place before. You just forget it because it's somewhat of a mystery to you. So, yeah, whether it's once a week or anything, I think sharing dreams is one of the most intimate things a person can do. An honest sharing of dreams is a very deep intimacy, and it's also a form of eros, a form of deep connection.
Mm-hmm. And obviously that feedback can help us to on the way to finding our destiny. You're going to be...
Especially when the outer world typically could care less if you find meaning in your life, could care less if you find understanding in your soul, could care less if you turn out to be the person your soul wants to be. People need an antidote to the modern world. The modern world is trying to turn everybody into everybody else. It's all about numbers. It's about the quantitative view of life. Paying attention to dreams and feelings and one's own story and even deep thoughts. That's part of the qualitative level of life. And everybody nowadays needs more quality and probably needs less quantity.
Mm-hmm. On Friday, January 28th from 7:30, you're going to be talking about facing fate and finding destiny at Unitarian Church on 49th and Oak in Vancouver. These tickets are available at Banyan Books or online. Who is this lecture for?
anyone, I would say probably starting from teenage to old age. As a matter of fact, I will talk about youth and the issues that come up in youth, because the core issues of one's life pronounce themselves during one's youth, and a person can go back and revisit them at any time in life. And then I'm very much like to talk about the difference between the elders, everybody grows older, and the elders, those who grow wiser.
Mm-hmm.
So it's for anyone. I don't think it's exactly for children, because I want to address the issues that people deal with in their conscious life. But although children do come and they enjoy the story part, because I tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
But it's open to, of course, the invitation to everyone. And from my point of view, stories are very deep and very woven with meaning, but that doesn't mean it can't be spoken in a pretty clear and available way. And so there's no educational requirement, and a person doesn't have to believe in any specific thing except that life is interesting and there's hidden beauty in it.
Mm-hmm. And the following day, Saturday, January 29th, from 9:30 to 5:30, it's a full day. The initiated soul, awakened self, a workshop with you. Can you tell our listeners, just in a couple of minutes, what is that workshop aiming to achieve?
Well, there's two sides to that. One is looking at a person's life, whatever it has been up to the given moment, up until that day, whatever age they happen to be. Things of meaning are happening all the time. It's just that they're not usually recognized in the modern world. So the first part of the event is to look at a person's life, looking for things that are initiatory. And what I mean by that are things that initiate, begin, start, not necessarily finish, but start the major themes of one's life. And so we do some work so that each person can find how these themes erupted into their life. And we look at what it means to have initiation. And initiation means to reveal oneself to oneself and to become in one's life who a person already is in their soul. And so that's that part of that. And then the second part of it is focusing more on the notion of something awakening from deep in the self. Jung, in Jungian psychology, calls it the deep self. It's also called the golden self, the jade heart. It has many, many names from all the different cultures in the world, but it's something that everybody carries and that everybody can become aware of. And so I want to address that and then offer some practices and some stories that help indicate how a person can find that awakened self and stay near it.
Hmm.
So that's the two parts of that all-day workshop.
Thank you. And I did have a chance to participate in the workshop, so I strongly recommend any listeners who are in town on January 28 and 29 to participate. Each time when I had opportunity to meet Michael, it is a life-changing and very profound experience. So thank you very much for sharing your wisdom and helping all of us to find our destiny.
Well, thank you, Andrew, for your kind words and for your own good work.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.
More information and tickets for Michael's lecture and workshops can be found on consciouslivingradio.org. We spoke with mythologist and storyteller Michael Mead. Good night. See you next week.
You have been listening to Conscious Living Radio, a program that explores frontiers of consciousness, spirituality, personal growth, the emerging paradigms in psychology, health, science, and innovative philosophies that reflect a commitment to the advancement of individual, social, and global transformation. Tune in every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m. to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. For information about our past and future programming and free downloads of shows, go to consciousliving.org.